Welcome to SCOTUSCast, the Federalist Society's podcast providing analysis on current decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Haley Reynolds, here to introduce the expert for our inaugural program, Richard Epstein, Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Chicago and Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. Professor Epstein is one of the nation's most prolific legal scholars. He is the author of many books, most recently, How Progressives Rewrote the Constitution, published in 2006, and numerous articles on a wide variety of legal and interdisciplinary subjects. Last week, the court handed down 5 decisions. The first 3 dealt with procedural issues, which are summarized briefly on the Federalist Society's SCOTUSCast page. The remaining 2 substantive rulings are the focus of Professor Epstein's comments today. The first was a decision nullifying a nearly $80 million punitive damages award against a tobacco company because the plaintiff appealed to the jury to punish the company for harm done to other smokers who were not parties to the litigation, which the court declared an unconstitutional seizure of private property without due process. The second case discussed the court's antitrust standard for predatory selling, which means artificially lowering prices to dry dock competitors, only to later raise prices to supra-competitive levels. The court decided to extend the standard to cases of predatory buying as well. And now, here is our expert, Professor Epstein.
Thank you, Haley. I'm pleased to do the first in what I hope will be a long line of distinguished Federalist Society broadcasts. As you mentioned, I'm here to talk about 2 cases. The first of these, Philip Morris versus Williams, is the latest in the Supreme Court's efforts to square large punitive damage awards with the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. An odd liberal-conservative 5-justice coalition, Breyer, Roberts, Kennedy, Souter, and Alito, held that Philip Morris could not be socked with a $75.5 million punitive damage award off a $821,000 award for ordinary damages, including pain and suffering, lost earnings, and medical expenses. The case expressly declined to pass on the 97-to-1 ratio between the actual and punitive damages, even though that figure lies well outside the earlier Supreme Court guidelines on the point, which look askance at anything over a 10-to-1 ratio. Instead, the decision went off on a second point, that the Oregon Supreme Court had allowed the punitive damages to be imposed for the wrongs that Philip Morris committed, not against this particular plaintiff, but against other Oregon smokers. The layers of irony run deep in this case. First, it is hardly clear that there should be any liability for tobacco at all. For no matter what Philip Morris has said over the years, it's hard to believe that anyone could have ignored the barrage of anti-smoking information that has been widely available for well over 50 years. But if the state courts go the wrong way, why do the federal courts get in under the due process clause that can't really decide whether it's a substantive or a procedural view? The best answer here, I think, is that the punitive damages are treated as a substitute for state fines, which the criminal process could never impose without going through a lot more hoops, including proof beyond a reasonable doubt and appellate review. When the tort system short-circuits any one of these devices, that penal substitute does not meet the exacting standards that are used whenever the far smaller fines are imposed through the criminal tort system. That shift back and forth between systems is a big deal, and the court has basically made the judgment that it is better to have a world in which you cannot get greater sums of money by meeting less exacting procedural standards. In this case, the concern obviously stems from the coordination of punitive damages across different lawsuits. With actual damages in the offing, why should any one claimant collect damages for the harms inflicted upon others? After all, those people can still bring their own suit. And if one person can get these outside punitive damages, then why are they not available to everyone else? The last thing the tort law has to worry about today is under-deterrence, and the 5 justices thought that the risk of over-deterrence was really too great to ignore. The editorial views were mixed again, as usual. The Wall Street Journal thought that half a loaf on tort reform was better than none, but it wished that the court had reimposed the 10-to-1 ratio, or perhaps an even a smaller ratio, that it had announced in earlier cases. That approach, in the end, might be more prudent, because no one is quite sure how the new jury instructions should be drafted, or whether they will make much of a difference when this case is brought to trial a second time. So this case does not do all that much to change the landscape, but it still has provoked sharp negative reactions. The New York Times, for example, thought that corporate wrongdoers had pulled another fast one on the justice system. On this case, however, I'm with the Wall Street Journal. I have consulted on and off with Philip Morris for many years on these cases, but my own views on the question were formed long before that engagement. I just wished the cigarette cases would go away for the reasons that seemed to be so persuasive to the consensus view 40 years ago. And I'm quite happy to decide whether or not to smoke on my own judgment, and don't think that the liability system, actual or punitive, has any role in these cases at all. Our second case, which also shows a distinct pro-defendant bias, is Weyerhaeuser versus Ross Simmons Hardware Lumber Company. That case involved a novel theory of antitrust liability for unilateral conduct, known as predatory bidding. That theory won the affections of the Ninth Circuit. In effect, the claim was that Weyerhaeuser had forced up the price by bidding on logs to the point where Ross Simmons was no longer able to compete, and therefore went out of business. The question was whether or not that claim for the loss of its business could be sustained under the antitrust laws. No, said a unanimous Supreme Court, speaking through Justice Thomas. The Supreme Court has made large strides in the law of predatory pricing, which is the converse offense. In particular, it has made it very difficult for a plaintiff to win a case where the defendants have priced their goods low today in the effort to drive out all competitors down the road in order to make a huge killing tomorrow. The court in these cases held rightly that the argument for predatory pricing could only work if the current prices are offered below cost and the scheme has some dangerous probability of recouping those losses. That dual test is a real death knell, because the initial price cuts spur huge demands that could create real losses. Yet when the prices go back up, competitors on the sidelines come back into the market, so that the grand strategy of predation almost always fails. Absent special circumstances, it can't work, and the Supreme Court therefore made it very difficult to prove these cases. The game with respect to predatory bidding is really no different, so the unanimous Supreme Court held. Here, if you really bid high and lose money on each transaction, where are the possibilities for recoupment? The simpler explanation is that the high consumer demand for end-state products drives an increase in the bids, which means that the price system is doing its job in allocating goods. The predation theory remarkably assumes that once a particular firm controls the field, it can thereafter reduce its input purchases to make a monopsony position as the sole or dominant buyer. But once again, the obvious question is, why won't other buyers come back in the market to pick up the slack so that the scheme itself has little or no chance of success? With a solid grasp of the economics, the court therefore adopted the flip side of the predatory pricing test. Now, in order to make out a claim for predatory bidding, the plaintiff has to prove that the defendant had sold the original bid products for prices that did not allow it to make a profit. And it has to prove further that once it turns out that these goods are sold in the later period, there was a dangerous chance that the scheme could succeed by allowing the predator to purchase goods at below competitive prices in the second period. All in all, that decision makes good sense. There is no categorical attack on unilateral pricing schemes, but it looks as though any effort to take over the market has to depend on special conditions that block free entry at the second or recoupment stage. American businesses can rightly breathe a sigh of relief that their every choice on how to price and bid for goods will not be routinely attacked by antitrust suits brought by disgruntled competitors. Yet what do these cases pretend about the future? Basically, improvement in two areas that are staples of the Supreme Court docket doesn't tell us very much about the future. There's an odd coalition in Williams, and there's a unanimous decision in Wirehouse. But what we have to worry about is whether or not the old liberal and conservative divisions will reemerge when the court gets to issues which are much more hotly contested. Prisoners' rights in Guantanamo Bay, abortions in the third trimester, state power under the Commerce Clause, and the doctrine of sovereign immunity. All of these issues are going to come up in due course, and there is no particular clue from what we've learned today as to how they will be decided. This is Richard Epstein, speaking for himself and the Federalist Society.